Thanks for the invitation. I'm really, really glad to be here. This is my first trip to Israel, and it's just been incredible. I come from the land of California. You may have heard of it, where all the fruits and nuts go. And honestly, I mean, I've been doing a lot of teaching and consulting around the country with what I do, which is leadership and small groups and that sort of thing. But I have been on an incredible learning curve about what goes on here. I've been sponsored by Harry and Dagmar. And basically, my mind is exploding because I basically had a CNN view of Israel. You know what that means? Yeah. So if here's reality, I get this piece over here. So I've got like, I understood 5%, and now I'm getting caught up on the other 95%. And just the incredible complexity and layers of what's going on spiritually, politically, economically. And I just appreciate what you guys do, and now I can, you know, be more effectively praying and supporting the work that goes on here for the kingdom. Also, I'm really into the food now. So if anybody knows a good place where I can get hummus and falafel in Southern California, you would help our ministry progress. When I was asked to speak to the congregation, I thought I'd like to speak on a topic that I've been working on for some time. I write books, and I'm writing a book on love. And love is one of those topics that you just hear all the time, and it's kind of like, oh, yeah, another talk on love. But I think there are some things that we can learn about love that can be of some value to us. But I really want to get a kind of a hands-on, everyday look at love, because sometimes we look at love as sort of one of those spiritual things that's up in the clouds, and we don't get it. And I want to talk about the goal of, I think, everybody here, which is to learn from God about love, because my conclusion on studying the scriptures about love is basically this, that's really all that matters. When it comes down to it, when you're at the end of your life or your ministry or a relationship, all that really counts is who we loved and how we love them. I mean, that's what God says. And so whatever ministry you guys are involved in, or whatever business you're in, or your relationships or family or marriage or your dating or whatever, all that really matters in the long run is we're going to be evaluated on who we loved and how we loved them. So there's really nothing more worthwhile to talk about. I think that probably the most loving person, when you know, everybody's got a picture of the most loving person that they've ever met in their mind, right? If you think it's yourself, that's a problem. But most of us think, yeah, there's this one person. And it might be a relative, or it might be somebody in your spiritual life, or someone who discipled you, or it could be a million people. Her name is Naomi. Naomi Barnes. Naomi was my grandmother. And she came from a small town in North Carolina, where I'm from, my mother's mother. And Naomi was not a highly educated person, didn't go to college back in those days, and never learned how to drive a car, and never went very far from her home. But she was known in her town of Black Creek, that was the name of the town, she was known there as the person to go to. You know what I mean? The person that when you've got a struggle, or you've got to figure out life, or something's like bigger than you are, she was the person that not only her family went to kind of as the matriarch, but also her neighbors and friends. She was the go-to person. She had 7 children, all girls. And my mother talks about her that way, that she remembers growing up and seeing people come to see Naomi for whatever reason and getting something from her. By the time they met with Naomi, when they walked away, something good had happened. And I don't know if I'm explaining this well, but that's how you know you're around a loving person. You walk away feeling more like yourself and more like who you'd like to be, and you've got enough grace to continue the struggle. My mother is 80
two, she would kill me for telling you that. Don't ever tell her I said how old she is. My mother's 82, and she still misses her. She still misses Naomi because she had such a profound influence and was such a source of love for her. I have my own memory of Naomi because she died when I was in college. So I grew up, I spent my childhood knowing her. And I remember when I was in college, I was, in those days, I was, you know, I went through my usual adolescent rebellion that we all go through. Yes, I was an adolescent 20-year-old. That's true. I just thought about that. Seemed kind of late, but I went through it. And, you know, I had the attitude and I had the hair and all that. And it's just something everybody goes through. My kids are, I've got teenage kids. They're going through it now, so I can feel their pain. They don't feel mine, but I feel theirs. But we all went through that. And so my parents and I were at odds and, you know, we didn't understand each other. And I felt really alienated and I felt really like nobody understood me and the older generation was a bunch of jerks. And it was not a good time for me. And I remember I went to see her. And I just went to visit her because that's what you do is you visit your grandmother. And when I came to the door, she lived on a farm. And she came outside and she said, "Don't come in the house." And I thought, right, because I'm a hippie, so you don't invite hippies into the house. She said, "Don't come in the house." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Come on outside." So I went outside and she took her spectacles and she twisted her spectacles so she could see me better. She had her hair up in the little granny buns that grannies do. And she said, she looked at me. I said, "What are you looking at?" She said, "I just want to see in the sunlight because your hair looks so great in the sunlight." I didn't know what to do because grannies don't say that. You know, I thought she'd have the kind of the polite denial of hair down to here. You know, like, "How's school? You know, how's your studies?" You know, I was waiting for that. That was fine. That's what grannies do. And she just wanted to, like, enjoy the relationship. And that profoundly affected me, that someone would be her age and her stature in life would be so warm with this insecure, alienated college kid. And I think it did something for me. It just kind of gave me a model, because we all have models in our mind of what love is about. And that's where I always go when I'm in struggle and that sort of thing. Well, if you asked her today, if she were alive and said, "What was your secret?" she wouldn't be able to tell you. And you ever notice that about really caring people? They don't know. You know, what is the secret if you're being a loving person? They'll say, Jesus. I know, everybody, that's always the answer, Jesus. Okay, but what's the real answer? And they'll say, patience, suffering, compassion. They don't know. You know what they know? They know they're just busy out there loving people. They live in the now. They live today. And all they care about is the connection. That's really where they live. And so what I wanted to do in the book that I'm working on is to unpack people like Naomi and other people in life, and see, let's get the anatomy of love. Let's do some architecture work here and unpack it and figure it out, because we all need to be loving people. And there's things we can learn about that. You know, if you look at the value of love, Paul says it best in 1 Corinthians 13. I was so glad you read from about love. Did you know what I was speaking on, Chuck? That's really weird, because I was thinking the same thoughts about the value of love. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, he says, "Without love," everybody knows this passage, "I'm either a noisy gong," right? "Or a what? A clanging cymbal. I am meaningless sound." And I don't think any of us want to go through life having made a lot of noise and never touching anybody and never connecting anybody. And that would be, I don't care how big the ministry is and how much we're doing and what the tasks are, if we don't go through life connecting with somebody, we're going to be a cymbal or a gong, and it's not going to count, and it's not going to do anything for us either. So it really behooves us to understand love. Let me give you my basic working definition of what love is, because there are a million of those. Some people say it's a feeling. You know, some people say it's a feeling of intimacy and closeness, and I think that's very, very much a part of it. Some people say it's basically a behavior. Love is what you do. And I think that's part of it. But I don't think either one of those, the feeling thing or the behavior thing or the real picture. I think that love is a value, a stance, an orientation. And I think it's this. Love is seeking the best of the beloved. Let me say it again. Love is seeking the best of the beloved. That in whatever I do with this person, I want their best. I want them to grow spiritually. I want them to be successful. I want them not to make mistakes. I want to be graceful for them. And that involves all those other things. It involves behavior and involves emotion and involves these things. But it's basically a way to address people. You know, sometimes the most loving thing you can do is not a very intimate thing. You ever had to confront someone that you loved who was making a mistake and tell them there's a problem here? You know, there's something you're doing that hurts my feelings. There's something you're doing. There's a habit, a behavior, an attitude you have here that's a problem. And sometimes that doesn't create a lot of kumbaya feelings among people, you know. Sometimes when you confront, they don't rise up and call you blessed. But it's still love, because it's taking the stance of wanting the best for my beloved. My beloved could be somebody I'm dating, or my spouse, or somebody in my family, or at work, or whatever. It's wanting their best. So what I want to do is to basically give you the main aspects I have discovered about what love is. And what you'll probably find out in this is that you'll say, yeah, I've got that one. I kind of do that one, but this one I didn't think about, or I need help in this one. Because I'd like for your takeaway to be, here's an area of love that I need to work on, that I need help in, that I need to grow in and develop in, because we're all supposed to be loving people in all those aspects. Well, the first part of love that all of us have to go through is that we've got to get it. You can't give it till you get it. I work with leaders a lot, Christian leaders around the country. I've spoken on these topics on 6 continents now. And if there's one, how many of you guys are in some kind of ministry or leadership? Okay. Well, there's something that Christians and Christian leaders have in common, is that we tend to be really good givers and really crummy receivers. I mean, the idea that I see from Christian leaders is, well, I'm supposed to receive love from God, and then I give love to everybody else. Now, what about those people in your life? I know, I'm supposed to be giving to them. I know, is anybody giving to you? Well, no, that's selfish. I get it from God. I had a quiet time today. I have a quiet time, and I get the goods from God, and I dispense it to the world that needs me. Well, that's not really what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches there are 2 sources of the love we need. One of those sources is God's direct intervention, the vertical part of life. Like you were talking about in 1 John 3 and also in 1 John 4, it says that God is what? Love. God is the primary source of love. He is it. He created it and all that. But there, besides the vertical part of love, guys, there's another part. Who wants to guess what it is? This is not a trick question. There's the vertical. Thank you. There's the horizontal. And the horizontal has to do with us. Like, one of the things I've really learned a lot since I've been here in Israel is how important relationships are, that life doesn't happen without relationships. You just can't call somebody up and say, okay, we got a meeting at 3:00. You got to say, how's the family? How are you doing? Sure is hot today. And if you don't do that, nothing happens. People just say, I'm not having a meeting with that person. They're a jerk. I think that's a really good thing, because there has to be a transfer of grace back and forth within each other. And sometimes Christians are good at the giving part and really bad at the receiving part. You know, in Psalm chapter 22, verse 9, there's kind of an amazing verse about the relationship of the vertical to the horizontal. And David says there, you have taught me how to trust in you at my mother's breast. You have taught me how to trust in you at my mother's breast. Well, let's look at that. He's talking about God and how God is connected to him and gives him grace. And he says, even as a baby, he was receiving from his mother the warmth and the safety and the love and the support and the empathy that he needed which in time would help him to trust in whom? In God. That what people experience with each other, when you guys are like talking to each other, when you're having lunch, when you're praying with each other, when you're opening up and being vulnerable with each other, you are receiving a grace that will ultimately bear fruit in trusting God. We learn about the invisible from the what? From the visible. It is the incarnation relationship that we have with each other that keeps us alive. I am a product of incarnation relationships. I have received so much grace from people in my life, and I've learned about God as a result. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 10 says that we are the stewards of His manifold grace. We are the delivery system, would be another way to say that passage. We are the distribution center for the grace of God. I remember when there have been times in my life, you know those dark nights of the soul when you don't know what you're doing or you're failing or you don't know the direction of God. And God has spoken to me direct ways and miraculous ways, and He's also spoken to me through people. Just the connection I had with somebody who understood and listened, like Naomi. And I cannot overemphasize that. That's why I mentioned that one thing I do when I train is I talk about small groups so much. I would hope that you have someone in life, not just Jesus, but Jesus with skin on. Because you need not just Jesus, you need Jesus with skin on to be a full New Testament Christian. And I hope there's somebody in your life that is safe for you, that you can be open with, that's not going to be condemning you or giving you a lot of judgment or harshness, but loves you and is on your side and is on your team. And I think you need more than that. And a lot of times when I talk to Christians about this, they'll go, yeah, I do that. Oh, tell me. Well, I've got Jesus and I've got my spouse. That's all I need. I get it from Jesus, I get it from my spouse, and I give it to the world. Praise me. And I say you have a problem. Your spouse is not enough. If you think your spouse is the only person you're supposed to unload to, check out your spouse. Just sit down and say, what is it like being the only person that knows everything about you? And see how she opens up with joy. You see, if your spouse is the only human that really knows your heart, your spouse gets overburdened. Your spouse becomes kind of like the listening post for everything in your life. And that is just not fair to do to anybody's spouse. The New Testament talks about the one another's. Love one another, accept one another, forgive one another, tell each other the truth. So there has to be some community. Break it out beyond your spouse. Give your spouse a break today. She will thank you. He will thank you. And they will rise up and call you blessed. So that's the reason that I believe that community needs to be, especially in the church, the big assembly, you know, where we learn the teaching of the word and we learn the surrender and we have the worship, the wonderful worship we had today, and we learn the church's movements. But we also have little places where we go where we've got time and we've got safety to unburden our hearts. So it's got to be received before we can give it. First Corinthians chapter 4 says, what do you have that you have not first received? Good lovers are good receivers. Okay. All right. Let me talk about some of the types of love now, because this is kind of what I've been enjoying learning, that there are different faces or aspects of love that all of us can benefit from. The first love I would call, the first type of love is connection love. Connection love. When you're able to connect on a deep and emotional level with some other person. Typically, this is something that women have an edge over us. I'm sorry, it's just true. Somehow, God gave women a little more of the ability to connect, and we gave men a little more of the ability to have kind of more of the aggressive impulses, which need to be restrained. But it's more of a people thing than a gender thing. I don't believe in this kind of like women are all connection and men are all task. I don't see that at all. But I do see an edge there. But the point is, you need to be able to learn how to listen to other people. Loving people listen to other people. Now, for example, in marriage, how many of you guys are married? Okay. How many are single? How many don't understand the question? Okay, so it's kind of half and half almost, maybe a little more married. You know how in marriage, you know, the wife's had a hard day, and she says, "Oh, it's been horrible. You know, the kids and work and the weather and the politics." And what do we guys do? We fix it. We have three solutions. We say, okay, I think the three Christian solutions that we do for everything are this. You need to have a quiet time. You need to start working out. And you need to take vitamins. Those are the keys to sanctification and transformation. And so the poor wife has had this horrible day and she hates everything and she just wants to unload. And then she finishes and he goes, "Do you have a quiet time?" "No, but I want to have one about you right now." "Did you work out? Did you take your vitamins?" You know, everything's those three. Now, those three things are great. I believe in them. But sometimes you got to just listen and not give advice. Connecting love is not advice-giving love. Connecting love is being there. It's the comforting of the Holy Spirit, the Paraclete, who comforts. The second aspect of connecting love is that it requires something of you. There's a difficulty. Because in connecting love, you must be able to take your point of view, your perspective, and put it on the back burner. The way you look at the situation, your own reality, your own opinion, you've got to take it and say, "I'm going to wait on that. I'm going to wait, put over here." And you must be able to enter the emotional world of the other person. That's when it talks about how Jesus was moved with compassion from his very bowels. That's what he was able to do. That's what the kenosis passage in Philippians 2 is about, how he set aside everything and emptied himself in order to love us. It's the setting aside of your needs, your interests, your own point of view, so that you can enter the other person's world. And it's not easy to do, because we are people who have the answer. We're just looking for people with questions. Please, God, give me somebody with a question today, because I got so many answers. Sometimes people need you to enter their world of what it's like to be them and to walk in their shoes and to know that they're hurt and that they're discouraged and that they're downcast, and just to be with them in that. And if you're one of those kind of positive Christians that has a lot of answers, this is going to be work for you. But you better do the work, because there's no way you can be a loving person unless you learn to listen and learn to listen empathetically and empathically. I'm kind of an answer person, and it took me a long time to learn that. Now it's okay. But once you do that and you realize that's all they needed, they didn't need to know that they had to have a quiet time. They knew that they needed me. That's what they needed. So connection is the first part. The second part is that there is is the action part of love. Love is also active. I believe that love is a verb. I don't believe it's a noun. And that a lot of people can have deep feelings for someone, but they never do anything about it. They just feel, it's like watching these soap operas. You know, people have all these feelings. Do you guys ever watch TV? Is that Christian here? TV? Okay. Christians don't watch TV, do watch TV. I don't want to step on anybody's toes here. Television's a rectangular object that has... Okay. And you see these soap operas, it's all this drama and all this intensity, but nobody ever does the right thing. They keep making mistakes and they keep ruining each other's lives. Love is not only connecting, but it also has actions to it. Some of you people are really good helpers, for example, really good at the kind of gifts of administrations and helps. And that is a very important part of love, because love has to be something we are doing. I think about my own father. And my own father is not a great connecting person. That's my mother. She kind of takes that on. But my dad is one of those people that can look at a situation and figure some things out to make it better. I remember when I was a little kid, I was in my teens, young teens, and I was in a music band. And I was a singer, and we needed a PA system, you know, like this. But back then, we didn't have stuff like this. And we didn't have the money for it, and I knew that we needed one. And one day, I walked downstairs, and he had built one, because he's good at electronics. And it was kind of his gift to me. He could never say anything to me like, "This must be difficult for you. What's it like? You know, what's your dream in music?" He didn't have those words. But he knew I needed something. So remember, in love, there's always something to do. Some of you guys are really great at hospitality, bringing a cake over, fixing somebody's car. And that's a great ministry of the church, as well as a great thing individually. That sometimes feelings are not enough. Some people just are in trouble, and they need a helping hand. And it's very practical and it's very hands-on. The next kind of love is what we would call healing love. Healing love. And healing love refers to the need that all of us have to address our own brokenness and our own imperfections and the fact that we're not done yet. Does anybody believe they're done yet? Raise your hands really high. How many of you think that you're not done yet, that God's not done with you yet? Okay, how many believe you're pretty much done and you feel sorry for all these other people that aren't done yet? Oh, that's too bad. Nobody raised their hand. Huh. I wanted the rest of you guys to see what denial looks like, but because we're not done. We see through a glass darkly. That's just the way it is. And we need the healing love of each other. And what that means is that we need to develop the capacity to provide what someone needs who is really in pain, to provide what someone needs who is really discouraged. You know, one of the great attributes and abilities, if you want to develop your healing love, is to learn to move toward pain and not away from pain. You ever talk to somebody when you were really struggling and all they wanted to do was cheer you up? You know, you just lost a relationship or there'd been a discouragement in ministry or work, and they wanted you to look at the bright side, and you just couldn't feel heard or understood. There's no healing there. I mean, we all need perspective, but you've got to connect with the dark side before anybody will listen to the bright side. Healing people are drawn toward the pain. They move closer. They give eye contact. They want to listen. They ask questions. They're not afraid of the pain. You know why? Because they have felt the compassion of Jesus in their own pain. They know what it's like to be healed. They know what it's like to have someone, as you're confessing your pain or your sin or whatever, who is eyeball to eyeball with you and says, "Tell me more. I want to know." In the States, there's a thing called shame-based groups, shame-based cultures. I don't know if you guys struggle with that. But with shame, you're supposed to just put your strong foot forward and your weak foot nobody's supposed to know about. So the parts of you that are in relationship are the parts that are have it together and are happy and positive and victorious. And nobody gets to know the other side. And it's really a disconnected way of living, and it's not New Testament living. Because the Bible says in Ephesians to live as children of the light. And the light is the light of love and relationship. All aspects of us are to be in relationship. People who are healing people know that the positive is not enough. They want to know the negative. And so healing people are never satisfied with just knowing the good things that are going on. They just say, "Doesn't seem like that. Seems like there's other things going on. Are you really okay? You ever had that kind of relationship? How are you doing? Good. Really? Yeah, really. Really? Okay, I'm lying." And then you have a great time. But that's what healing love does. And that capacity is a tremendously valuable capacity that heals the body and it heals the soul and makes people better to go on in their lives and their ministries. Then there's the fun one, the romantic part of love. You can never talk about love until you talk about romance. Because God made romance. Men and women were supposed to have romantic feelings toward each other. It's also the source of great craziness, too. But who cares? It's great. Romantic love, either with your spouse or someone you're dating or whatever, basically is overrated in how we do it. Because a lot of people think you've got to generate feelings or, you know, make yourself feel things. That's not how God created us. Romance and passion come from two sources. And if you do these sources, romance and passion occur. The first one is romance and passion come from the connection itself. That's where you begin finding, like, in marriages, when two people find that the intimacy is not there, they find that they're not talking to each other and nobody's listening. And so all of a sudden they add that in there and one person starts listening better and the romantic feelings begin to develop, because romantic feelings are always on the other end. They're a result. They're an effect. They're a fruit. The second thing is that romantic feelings come with when there's respect. Now, you don't think of respect as a very romantic. It sounds kind of like something you do in a business. But what respect means is I give you freedom to be different. When you respect someone you love, you give them the freedom to be different. to have a different opinion, to have a different value, to have a different feeling. And when people don't feel that kind of respect, they can't feel passion because they feel like they're in a jail. I've worked with so many struggling marriages where one person was controlling the other person to feel like they felt. And they wondered why there was a flat deadness in the relationship. There is no secret to that. It was flat and dead because one person said, "You do it my way, you feel it my way, that's what we're doing." And the other person's heart just went away. And that's the way it should happen. It's like, if you're into mathematics at all or physics, it's like a law of physics. You remove freedom, you remove passion. So there's a price to pay. If you want a spouse who never disagrees with you, you can get that, but you won't get passion. If you want passion, you got to have somebody who'll disagree with you. And so a lot of people say, "Gosh, that's bad news. I don't think I want anybody that gets in my face and says no to me and disagrees and has different feelings." But I think it's the way to go. I think that's why Jacob wrestled with God. I think that's what the New Testament talks about, is speaking the truth and love to each other. Passionate people have respect for each other and disagree. Then there's the face of love that we call confrontation. I mentioned earlier that sometimes when you got to tell somebody the truth, it doesn't feel very loving, but you know it is. Because I believe that we owe each other confrontation. We have what psychologists call blind spots. All of us has a blind spot. If you don't think you have a blind spot, that's your blind spot. We all have hidden, you know, wrong attitudes and wrong behaviors. And part of the ministry of the body to each other is to shine light on the blind spots. And confrontive love says, "I care about you, but there's a problem here." When Chuck asked who's read the books on boundaries, my partner Henry Cloud and I have written many books on boundaries because so many Christians know a lot about caring, but they don't know a lot about truthing. And every time there's a truth, it feels harsh or mean, or they're afraid they're going to lose a relationship. And nothing could be further from the truth. The best relationships are those where people confront each other in love. You know, in the Latin, the word confront actually means to turn your face towards someone. Confront, front of your face. It's a relational term of connection. And I believe that we ought to restore confrontation to love. I've got a really good friend. I've been meeting with him regularly for 20 years. He knows everything about me. I know everything about him. And in the early days of our relationship, we had a hard time confronting because, you know, confrontation is not fun. Love is fun, but confrontation is not so much fun as like surgery. And so we didn't do it well at first, and we would say, you know, "I want to tell you something I'm noticing about you," and the other person would get mad, and, you know, you had to have these four-hour conversations about what did you really say that I think you meant, that you understood that I think you might have said. But we kind of worked it out because he's really a great guy, and he loves God, and he loves me, and I like his values, and he likes, you know, being with me. So we kept working at learning how to confront. And we were having lunch a couple of weeks ago, and he said to me, "You know, last time we met, you kind of hurt my feelings." And I thought, "Oh, tell me about it." He says, "Well, I was talking about the struggle in my marriage, and I thought you kind of cut me off and didn't really, thought you were kind of, I don't know, hard with me." I said, and I thought about it, and I thought, "Yeah, you know, I think I really was. I don't think I was really in a really listening mood there, and I'm sorry, and, you know, I think I did that. And so let me know if I do it again. Sorry about that. You know, you confess and press." And so he said, "You want some coffee?" That was it. Took us 30 seconds. After 20 years, took us 30 seconds. Because we have worked a long time on confronting in love so that nobody loses the connection anymore. And we can say really direct things to each other, and it helps me so much to get his perspective on how I'm doing, and I do the same thing with him. I hope for you that you feel safe connecting, safe confronting, because Christians, more I speak on this material, I mean, that's why we wrote all these books on boundaries. Christians don't get the skill of confronting. We don't know how to confront. We're afraid of it. It doesn't go well. We kind of get indirect. We never get to the point. We don't want anybody to hate us or get mad at us. And here's the bottom line of confronting. You're going to make somebody mad in life, guys. If you keep everybody happy, something's wrong with you. You know, Luke chapter 9, Jesus said, "Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for so they treated the false prophets in their day." The prophets that were tickling their ears with positive things. Jesus said, "Woe to you if everybody likes you." Now, so for some of you, you're feeling relief right now. Okay, I must be doing good because everybody's mad at me. That's great. But here's the thing in life. It's not whether you make anybody mad. Are you making the right people mad? Are you disappointing the right people? If you're frustrating controlling people, if you're frustrating self-centeredness, if you're making irresponsible, lazy people mad, go for it. You're advancing the kingdom of God. Don't make broken people mad. They're broken. Don't make the wounded mad. They need help and they need compassion. So the goal in life, one of the goals in life is, I mean, you're not supposed to do this on purpose, but as you go through life, just make sure that the people that are annoyed with you are the right people. And then there's surrendering love. And surrendering love has to do when we have to surrender what we would like in a relationship for other realities. You know, because I mentioned earlier that love means you've got to give people choices. You've got to give people free will. You know, one of the basic facts of our spiritual life is that God chose us, but knows that we don't have to choose Him. And He withstands the pain and He withstands the hurt, even though He chose us and died for us, that we can still shake our fist at Him and say, "I don't want you." He gives us that because He knows that if we're not free to reject Him, we're not free to do what? Accept Him. You can't be free to reject God, to accept God, unless you are free to reject God. It's the whole power of God's toleration of us. And that surrendering love is very important, not only in God's heart, but in ours. That you might have someone who is disconnecting from you, or is upset with you for the wrong reasons, or doesn't want to hear what you have to say, or somebody that you want something from, and they don't want to give it. And surrendering love says, "I accept that I can't control this relationship. And I am for you, and I want your best. And I'm going to have to go through some grief and some sad feelings and let go of something because I can't make this relationship work if you don't want it." Remember Luke 15 and the prodigal son? And the father said, "Here's a half of the inheritance." How do you think that felt to him as a dad to watch his son go off and waste it all when he could have said, "You're not getting anything. You got to get your act together before I'll give you the inheritance"? But he knew what his son needed to do, and the son had to go grow up and come back. I remember when one of my kids, they were young and really young, and I heard a noise in the living room and something crashed. You ever had an experience? You're in another room, there's a crash. You know something good didn't just happen, right? And I went in there, and the one that normally breaks things was standing there. Because I have one that doesn't break things and one that does break things. And so I said to the one that broke things, "I know what you did." I mean, I immediately assumed he did it. And his brother didn't help me at all. You know, he just kind of stood there like. So I said, "You know, you're going to get disciplined for this." And I gave him a hard time. And finally, the brother that didn't break finally came in and said, "I did it. It's my fault." And I had to go to my son that I disciplined wrongly and say, "I am sorry. I am so sorry. That's not what I wanted to do. And I'm sure I hurt your feelings." And he was so wounded and so not trusting me anymore. And he was so upset with me. So I said, "You know, I want to make sure you know this was me, not you. This is not your fault. Will you forgive me?" And he said, "No." And I thought, that's not the way this is supposed to go. When the dad gets on his knees and says, "I'm sorry," then he's supposed to come up and hug me and we cry together and then we go get ice cream. Right? That's how this is supposed to go. And he didn't see that movie, I guess. And he said, "No." And I said, "Why not? I apologized." He said, "I'm still mad at you. You really hurt me." I thought, yeah, I did, didn't I? So I went into my arguing mode. And I said, "Okay, are you ever going to forgive me?" And he goes, I don't know. I mean, he wasn't giving me any grace on this one. I said, okay, what else can I do here? Christian father, Christian son, we got to work this out. Okay, if you ever do forgive me in your life, hypothetically, would you tell me? Because I need to know, because I'm kind of in purgatory here, you know. So if you ever decide to forgive me before you die of old age, would you tell me? He goes, all right. Thank you. So I had surrendered my right to extract forgiveness from him, and I had to let it go. So I go through the whole, this was on a Saturday, there was no school, we were just doing things at the house. I went through the whole day unforgiven. That's not fun, to know somebody that you've hurt will not forgive you. You just feel bad, and I feel like a bad guy, and I, you know, it was a horrible day, but I surrendered the right to push him. And finally, at the end of the day, we had our little family prayer thing, and I was up on his bunk bed and praying. We finished praying, and I turned his light off and said goodnight, and I'm halfway down the hall, and he goes, Dad. I said, what? He says, come here. I said, what? I walked over the bed. He goes, I forgive you. Thank you. He got me out of jail. Well, the point of that little story is that sometimes the thing you want in the relationship is not the thing somebody is willing to give you. And you have to give them that because they cannot give to you wholeheartedly and personally until they can choose not to. And that is the hardest thing about our faith. But the best news is that's what God did with me. And that's what God did with you. And every day He accepts that in some part of our hearts we shake our fist and He surrenders. He says, well, come to me, the great Shema. Hear me. But you've got to choose. You've got to choose who you're going to serve. And I'll give you time to choose. Well, this is a 300-page book, so forgive me if it sounds kind of like way too, you know, of an overview. But we need a model of love, because otherwise, if we don't see how practical and realistic it is, we just kind of forget of its importance. And love is about reality. So Chuck said that if people had a question or two, that we could sure talk about them. Now, as a psychologist who speaks a lot, let me tell you how to do this. The way you answer, because some of this is personal, right? So the way to ask the question is do this. Raise your hand and say, I have a friend. And my friend has a question, and then we'll answer your friend's question and pray for your friend, and you can go home and show your notes to your friend and help them. So, any questions about this kind of stuff? The question is, had I not had a Naomi to model that for me, would I've ever gotten it, kind of a thing? I think there's two answers to that. The first is a providence of God answer. You know, some people come from really bad families and lots of hurt and lots of pain. And I think that God provides for those people in other ways. For some people, it was a neighbor. If their parents were crazy or disconnected or legalistic and they hurt them, some people had a neighbor that came in. Some people had an aunt or a warm teacher or Sunday school teacher or something like that. But it's sort of like it says in Psalm 68 that He's a father to the fatherless and He provides a home for the lonely. So I think for everybody that has not in the biological family, that there's spiritual family out there. But I think the second answer is that for some people, if I'd never had a Naomi, I believe that later in life, God would have provided me a Naomi. Like, that's why I believe so much in the healing power of the body. If you're 30 and you never had a Naomi, then the second act of your play is you got to find people with grace. It's kind of the reparenting of the body. The body reparents what the biological family did not follow through with. The body comes in with the grace and the warmth. That's why Jesus said, "Who are my mother and my brothers and my sisters but those who do the will of God?" So sometimes we got to get in adulthood the stuff from the body that didn't happen the first time around. The question, let me answer this for the purpose of the group here, the congregation. The question is, there's a struggle with your sister in Haifa, and could someone do the counseling? I'm kind of disqualified because I'm on my time is almost gone here. But the host organization that brought me here, people in leadership of this church, are really into body life and the power of that. And I think maybe the leaders can find somebody. I have noticed that a third party can often help a love connection gone wrong, because the third party can be seen as neutral and say things to the people that they don't react to. There's kind of a teaching that comes out with people that want to be an agape lover, like agape meaning the pure, altruistic, supernatural love that God has for us, the giving love. And some people say, well, just do it and the feelings will come later. And I have not found that to be true either. Let me explain what I think really happens. Let's suppose either you're with someone that's kind of unlovable or unlikable, and you care about them, but they're just prickly, or they're defensive, or they're just whatever. They blame everybody in the world but themselves, and they're just a frustrating person. If you don't feel the overflowing of love toward them, I think that has two causes, and there's something we can do about it. The first cause is that we've got an empty tank. Many times, if you find you can't have loving feelings for somebody, it's because you yourself have not been to the water. And it sometimes means to me, I've got to make another phone call or have another coffee with someone or go get prayed for. I've got to get my love tank full from God and other people so that I have enough wherewithal to give to this person. And this person is going to take a lot. You know, I need to get some high test here because they're tough. So one problem is that there's not enough in me. The second problem, though, has to do with this: do I need something from this person? People that are difficult in our lives become more difficult when we are dependent on some result from them, that they will appreciate us, that they will give us respect, that they will listen to us, that they will see it our way. When you need something from a difficult person, you're kind of in jail because it's not going to be coming. And so a lot of times we have to release it and go, you know, whatever I needed from that person, I'll get it over here with God and my friends. Then it frees me up to love them just as they are without them coming our way. And so either I deal with my dependency or I deal with my own emptiness, and it tends to, I've got something more to offer. Which, again, that's kind of how God treats us. So.